the year.
Recreating notable events of passing time. Reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world. That was the year. The festive Christmas and New Year holiday season had hardly waned until millions of Britons throughout the world came to the sudden, shocking realization that their beloved Queen Victoria was lying on a deathbed at Osborne House on the Isle of Wight, a palace replete with tender memories for the 82-year-old monarch. Members of the House of Hanover had been summoned to attend the matriarch, and the two most conspicuous figures in the room were eldest son, the Prince of Wales, soon to succeed his mother as Edward VII, and her eldest grandson, William II, Emperor of Germany. And so on January 22, the very anniversary of the death of her father, the Duke of Kent, at precisely 6:30 o'clock in the evening, Victoria Regina passed into the realm of the world's immortals in the 64th year of her reign.
19-1, that was the year.
Topeka, Kansas, February 5. Outside the ornate Senate saloon, about 4:30 in the morning, stand three women.
Got your hatchet, Kelly?
You bet I've got it. Come on, girls.
Kelly, there's a slot machine.
Yes, I see it.
Hey, lady, you can't do that. Hey, you quit that now.
Let me go. You can't stop me. I'm going to slice this joint until there isn't a vestige of it left. Come on, girls.
Mrs. Carrie Nation, nemesis of proprietors of so-called joints, soon found herself once more in the clutches of the law, but subsequently released on $100 bail. 3 days later, at a meeting of her followers...
Do you mean to tell me, Carrie Nation, that you aren't going through with this raid?
No, I'm not. I'm tired. I'm going home.
You're a coward, Mrs. Nation. You're a coward.
No, I'm not a coward. I'll go this minute with any woman and smash a joint.
I'll go.
No, I've changed my mind. I'm tired. The law doesn't wish me to go out tonight.
The next day, Mrs. Nation recounted the meeting to newsmen.
Oh, it was beautiful to see how angry they were. It was a delicious half hour. I never was so happy in my life. I would rather die at the hands of those indignant women than saloon keepers.
That was the year.
Manila, Philippine Islands, March 8th.
Captain Hazard.
Sir.
Captain Newton.
Here.
Lieutenant Hazard.
Here, sir.
Lieutenant Mitchell.
Here, sir.
Now we're all ready. We have the forged letters from Awanaldo's General Lasuna, telling Awanaldo that his brother is sending a company of his best soldiers. We are to pose as captives of Hilario Placido and his men. You understand, Hilario?
Si, senor.
Very well. Let's get aboard.
Yeah, come on, boys.
Thus did Brigadier General Frederick Funston of the U.S. Volunteers, four other American Army officers, and 78 sympathetic Filipinos embark on the U.S. gunboat Vicksburg to begin their adventurous attempt to capture Emilio Aguinaldo, insurrection leader. On March 14, the Vicksburg put out her lights, ran ashore 25 miles south of Casiguran, then began the arduous trek across 90 miles of rough country, swift rivers, precipitous mountains, dense jungles, lack of sufficient food and clean water, added to the difficulties. Finally, the courageous party arrived within 8 miles of Palanan, the village where Aguinaldo was purported to be hiding. Messengers were dispatched informing the rebel leader that the reinforcements promised by Insurgent General Lasuna had arrived, and that en route they had met American troops, had killed some and captured five. Aguinaldo sent food and a message that the American captives were to be treated kindly. On March 23, while his neatly uniformed personal guard stands in formation outside to greet the newcomers, Aguinaldo stands inside his makeshift headquarters, talking to his treasurer, Santiago Barcelona.
When these men arrive on the Argo, we will prepare for another attack. What is going on out there?
Maybe the men of your guard are celebrating the arrival of the reinforcements.
Fools! Stop that foolishness! Quit wasting ammunition!
Aguinaldo! Look out!
Emilio Aguinaldo! You are prisoner of the Americans.
No, no.
I will not be taken.
I will not.
Yes, no.
I will not be.
Throwing small statured Aguinaldo to the floor, corpulent Hilario Placido sat upon the insurgent leader until help arrived, and he was placed in the official custody of the American officers. At length, Aguinaldo resigned to his fate, acquiesced to peaceful captivity, and on board the Vicksburg made this statement.
Yes. Yes, I am beaten. I have no wish to die. I wish only to serve my people. I will swear my allegiance to the American flag.
And so ended a completely unexpected conflict. A war which had lasted six times as long as the Spanish-American War, which cost more than half as much, and which made an overnight hero of Brigadier General Frederick Funston.
19-1. That was the year.
Buffalo, New York, September 6. At about 4 p.m., President William McKinley, accompanied by his secretary, George B. Cotelu, president of the Pan-American Exposition, John C. Milburn, and a group of Secret Service detectives, enters the spacious Temple of Music, especially arranged so that he may greet and shake the hands of exposition visitors. A sudden disturbance at the door draws the attention of several of the presidential guard. Order is quickly restored, and then Secret Service agents Foster and Allen notice a man of swarthy complexion and slight stature approaching the president. The man's hand is bound in a handkerchief and rests partly inside his coat. One of the agents turns to the other.
That man has a sore hand.
Don't know about that, George.
Mr. President! Mr. Milburn, help me here. Mr. McKinley, do you suffer much pain?
George.
Yes, sir?
My wife. Don't let her know about this. And if she does find out, don't let it be exaggerated.
Yes, sir.
What are they doing to that man? Boys, don't be too hard on him. Mr. Milburn.
Yes, Mr. President.
I'm sorry that this should have happened at the exposition. So sorry.
With three thoughts for his wife, for his assassin, and for the harm the tragic event might have upon the success of the fair, William McKinley proved the most calm, a mighty oak among all present on that day. Upon receiving dispatches of the precarious condition of McKinley, Vice President Theodore Roosevelt and all but two of the cabinet officers rushed to Buffalo and directly to the Milburn home whence the president had been taken. That night, the first encouraging bulletin from attending physicians appeared.
The president is rallying and resting comfortably. At 10:35 p.m., the temperature was 104 tenths degrees. Pulse, 124. Respiration, 24.
Throughout the next days, the nation's citizens read with mounting relief the reassuring medical bulletins. But on the 13th, a new note of alarm appeared. Roosevelt, who had joined his family in the Adirondack Mountains, was warned to hold himself in readiness for an emergency. And when he reached North Creek, New York, he found officials of the railroad and the road's fastest train awaiting him, and a telegram from Secretary of State John Hay.
The president died at 2:15 o'clock this morning.
That afternoon, as high government officials gathered in the living room of the Ainsley Wilcox home, all with unashamed tears, John Hay faced Theodore Roosevelt.
Mr. Vice President, I've been requested on behalf of the cabinet of the late president to request, for reasons of weight affecting the affairs of government, that you should proceed to take the constitutional oath of office of President of the United States.
I shall take the oath at once in accordance with your request. And in this hour of deep and national bereavement, I wish to state that it shall be my aim to continue absolutely unbroken the policy of President McKinley for the peace and prosperity and honor of our beloved country.
Judge Hazel, please.
The Bible, Mr. Roosevelt. Do you solemnly swear that you will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of your ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States?
I so swear.
And thus began the vigorous, colorful administration of the man whose political enemies had sought to suppress his fervor by relegating him to the vice presidency. McKinley's assassin, Leon Czolgosz, whose only excuse for his act was that he was an anarchist, a disciple of Emma Goldman, was brought to speedy trial, executed at Auburn Prison, October 29.
19-1. That was the year.
That this new song by Harry Von Tilzer first appeared to stir the heartthrobs of an English-speaking world.
The ballroom was filled with passions throng. It shone with a thousand lights. And there was a woman who passed along, the fairest of all the sights. A girl to her lover then softly sighed,
See you.